Hello and welcome to There's No Business Like, a podcast where friends and industry colleagues explore topics and interview leaders in our industry of professional theatrical touring.
Thank you for joining us this week. I'm Josh Benson, here with the No Business Like podcast from Marion, Illinois at the Marion Cultural and Civic Center, and I've got my friends with me here today. Kevin.
Kevin Maynard, Quad City Arts, splitting the border between Iowa and Illinois.
Katie.
Katie Miller, Midland Center for the Arts in Midland, Michigan.
Brian.
Brian Zellmer from Kutztown, Pennsylvania at Kutztown University.
And best for last, Danielle.
Danielle Van Hook from the Alden in McLean, Virginia.
So we've got a good conversation coming up for you today. But before we get into that, a quick question for all of you. Is there something that you were really, really good at as a child that you thought you were going to be doing for the rest of your life?
Well, Josh, I remember telling my swim coach in the fifth grade that I wanted to be in the Olympics for swimming, and I remember her laughing. So I don't know if that qualifies for this question because I wasn't technically that good at swimming. I think for a hot second, I did think that maybe the Olympics was possible, but it turns out it wasn't. But I did get really good at selling raffle tickets prior to performances to win a basket, and that did kind of serve me well in learning how to fundraise.
When I was younger, I wanted to be a pastor, and I was really good at leading like vacation Bible schools and doing like mini sermons. But that is not what I do anymore.
I thought I was going to be one of two things. One, I thought I was really funny, and so I thought I was going to be a comedian or a professional basketball player and the next Michael Jordan. Which very clearly I've achieved both.
All right. When I was in third grade, I like lived in my imagination and imagined being a violinist, even though I never even picked up an instrument or had an instrument. And eventually my grandmother supported that and got me into local lessons. But she kind of said, hey, you're going to do better at this program at this college. And so in third grade, I started taking college level violin. And I was really good at it. The only thing is, it was on Saturdays and we had to drive all the way to New Paltz, New York, which was like an hour and a half drive from my house. And so my whole Saturdays were shot and I wanted to play with my friends at that age. And so I regret giving it up. But after I had to finish the term and then I gave it up and I look back and I'm like, oh, that's one of the regrets I have in life.
The thing I was really good at, I started dancing when I was three and I was a pretty good dancer all through my childhood. And then into high school, I was doing musicals and I really thought maybe I would pursue a career as a Broadway dancer. Like that's really something I thought about a lot. But I think it became pretty evident as I got older that I didn't have the right or expected body type for that sort of profession or what, you know, 25 years ago was thought as the proper body type to be a professional dancer. And so that dream got kind of quashed when I was in high school. And I just realized that like, even if I had the talent, I just didn't fit the mold. And so that dream went away pretty fast and I transitioned to other things and that's okay. And I don't think that like was the path I was supposed to take. But, you know, as a particularly a young woman, body image issues can be pretty serious. And it was just a little disheartening to be like, oh, like this is something I can't control. But yet, you know, it defines at least what I can't do in the future in some way, shape or form. So I've gone back to dance now as an adult, but I took an 18-year break from dancing consistently between when I graduated high school and going back to class a couple years ago.
Katie, that's actually perfect to lead us into this interview with Mark Morris and Nancy Umanoff. Kevin and I had the chance to sit down with them. And one of the topics that comes up is the traditional stereotypical dancer body type. So enjoy this conversation with Mark Morris and Nancy Umanoff.
It is I, Mark Morris, and I am a choreographer of dances. I have my own company, the Mark Morris Dance Group and Music Ensemble, forever. I conduct a little. I direct operas. I've done a lot of work with ballet companies, but principally I work with my own wonderful set of dancers and musicians.
I'm Nancy Umanoff, Executive Director of the Mark Morris Dance Group, a partnership that I've been in for 38 years.
Thank you both for joining us today. We are delighted to have you. Let's start with just a little bit of background. Tell us how you got into dance in the first place. We'll start with Mark, and then we'd love to hear your story as well.
Everybody dances. That's what children do. Like walking is dancing, right? Then you add like a limp or a hop or a skip or whatever. You turn around, you go up and down, in and out. That's what you do. And it gets more complicated until naturally. It just happens to just about every kid. And at a certain point, it's sort of not part of your life when you start to lose the support for your imagination. And if you keep going, it becomes a wonderful sort of weird life to have, to dance professionally or to, you know, just have had dance part of your life. So I danced around, let's call it that. And then when I was probably 8, my mother took me to see a flamenco company at that time. It was Jose Greco and his partner, Nana Lorca. And I saw them and I said, I want to do this kind of dancing, which was Spanish dance, not exclusively flamenco. And my mother found me a teacher, looked up in the yellow pages under dance lessons or something. And I started working one day a week alone, private lessons with this wonderful woman named Verla Flowers. I grew up in Seattle. That's where that was. And so I learned within a vacuum, basically, how to dance this very interesting style of dance, of rhythmic dancing and mostly solo dancing. I learned a lot. And then I went on from there, a lot of folk dancing, studying ballet and other sort of modern dance forms, and just becoming extremely interested in music and in dancing. And so the rest is herstory. I started my company in 1980 as the Mark Morris Dance Group. And I had danced with a number of wonderful dance companies before that.
Nancy.
So like most kids, I did dance around when I was little. I actually took classes starting probably around 8 or 9 years old, danced really recreationally. And when I went to school, when I went to college, I did end up majoring in dance, but the intention was really to major in anatomy and physiology and study forensic pathology and dance. But in college, I got a little bit more of the dance bug, decided to pursue that. And it was really in my senior year when I was doing some dancing. I was booking the student company in shopping malls, doing some lighting design and some stage management, thinking, this is what I want to do. What is this called? And somebody said it was arts management. That summer, I worked at a arts festival, and then I applied to graduate school and got my master's in performing arts administration. Interned at a small dance company and then at Pentacle Dance Works, which is where I got my first job and met Mark. I was running the Foundation for Independent Artists, which was somewhat of a precursor to fiscal sponsorship. I did the company's finances and grant writing, and Mark was one of 9 of my companies. And it was, I guess, 2 years into that that I started working directly with Mark, and that was 1986.
Excellent. I'm curious, is, you know, your partnership obviously is what led to a lot of these successes. So I'm curious from Mark, from your aspect, like why Nancy? And then kind of so let's start there. Like what drew you to bringing Nancy into the company?
I was working with a close friend and partner who was helping me figure out how to put on a show, because I'd moved to New York when I was 19, and I put on my first show as the Mark Morris Dance Group when I was 24, I think, because I danced with several companies, wonderful companies, and I was always choreographing from when I was a teenager. I was writing my own grants and trying to figure out how to do this stuff with zero education. I didn't go to university, or I didn't go to a conservatory. It's the school of hard knocks and trial and error. It's like, you know, this was very interesting. And I started putting on shows in Seattle, where I was living some of the time, and in New York. And then I applied for a grant. I did some of this stuff with this fellow and me. And we got to a point where we had a check from a gig. I basically didn't know what to do with it. And we went to Pentacle and met with Nancy, who managed my company as, you know, under this umbrella. That was it. We went in and talked. Her story, which is true, is that I was wearing Highway Patrol mirrored sunglasses that reflect yourself. So she was talking to me, asking me questions, and she's seeing herself, and I'm hiding from her. And so I whipped off the glasses, and my beautiful eyes seduced her into working with us for the next many, 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 many years. So it was like, you know, how much do you pay? What's the contract? What's the work like? It's like, well, that's the part you get to decide.
It's a great perk.
Because I can't do that. I can't do that shit. I can choreograph and I have a few skills, but, you know, she knows how to do it. And the rest, it just went from there.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing, complicated, fabulous way.
Well, first I want to tell that story from my point of view.
I think there's the other
side of it, which is true, right? I think the check was from BAM, where they said, who do I write the check to? And Mark said, you write it to me. And they said, we're not writing it to you. You'll lose it all in taxes. Go to, you know, Pentacle. And so that's how we first met.
Yeah.
But I had seen the company's work. I was young and I was nervous to meet Mark and in that first grant meeting. And I was looking at myself sweating in his reflective aviator glasses. And I did say, can you please take those off? And he did. And yes, there were sparkling blue eyes.
Right.
But I dazzled you with my eyes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think what was really dazzling was the work. Mm. You know, I loved dance. I knew I wanted to work in dance. And I never thought I would work for one artist with one company. I thought I would either work for a service organization like Pentacle or a presenting organization. The more that I saw Mark's work, the more that I was drawn in, the more that I brought people to it, even more so than I do now. Like, oh, you have to come see this. Come to, you know, dance theater workshop, sit on the floor. But for me, it was really about the music. And it was about hearing music that I knew really well, as if I was hearing it for the first time, or hating a piece of music and understanding how to navigate it because of what I was seeing. It was because of the work that I sort of accepted the challenge of come work with us. And it was, you know, what, doing what? I don't know. What do you need? You need a fundraiser. Well, you can fundraise. Well, I don't want to fundraise. You know, well, how much can you pay me? Well, you can't. You don't have the money to pay someone. And I did go home. I was probably 25 years old, I think, at the time. And I went home and I, you know, did this whole proposal and I came back to, you know, pitch it. I was like, yeah, that sounds good. You know? And I think what's worked is that I see my job, and I have for the last X number of years, whether it was just one or two of us working or the 196 employees we have now, wow. My job is to create the environment for Mark to create work. And that has allowed it to be what it is. So I also think there's a tremendous amount of trust. I used to joke that Mark didn't know where we were going on tour until I handed him the plane ticket, when there were actual paper plane tickets, because it wasn't important information to know the details unless there was something different or new or something that involved artistic decisions, right? That was his domain and that was protected. And it was my job to sort of create that for him. I've never tried to cross that line. I mean, I'll give my honest opinion about the work or what I think about collaborators or any sort of artistic decision that he may make, but I don't try to make up dances. I don't try to do his job and he doesn't try to do mine. And so I think that's where that trust comes from.
And he has zero desire to do yours.
And I have zero desire to do his.
Yeah. My joke is she does 97% of the job and I do 3, and that's including choreography. So maybe it's more like 2, but I don't know. I have guilt that I don't work as many hours as some people do, like Nancy, for example, but it's a whole different job, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like everything I do is my job, which was difficult during the pandemic part of the COVID period. I've just like, I didn't have much to work on. And so to get back to work as slowly and really carefully as we did has been great. So now we're people say ramping up or something. There's more work, but it's still very dicey. So anyway, I don't perform anymore. And I have a wonderful, Sam Black is the company director. So he runs the rehearsals that I end up like working on 5 bars of music for an hour and a half. And you don't really need to do that unless you're making something up. So the maintenance and the keeping the dances in shape and in, you know, ready to be performed is what Sam does now. And of course the dancers and the musicians and all of us, but we just have, it's become specialized in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I have more schmoozing time. I have more time to go around and do stuff and study music and work on things. It's less time in the studio, but that's kind of good because then I just go in quite single-mindedly and can work on, you know, I'm working on a dance right now. That's my chief joy and desire and one of my skills. It's not the only one, but it's close. So
I think what's really fascinating about this partnership is that you are both very passionate about like the different sides of the business, mm-hmm. But you were still both doing it for the art, like for the work itself. Like that's what I think is really interesting.
Shocking.
Create. Like it's one of the things that I'm really fascinated about with Mark Morris Dance Group is that transition from taking it from a touring dance group to a physical location in Brooklyn, I'd love to talk a little bit about that. You know, obviously, like that process started in sort of 1991 area. What brought that about, and what were the sort of the hurdles to get that to being open?
It actually started way before that. I mean, the quest for a home was always there, right? I mean, once there was consistent work, one of the most amazing opportunities was the company being in residence at the Teatro Royal de la Monnaie in Brussels, where we were for 3 years. And what that experience taught us, well, among many things that it taught us, was the importance of having a home, right? A place where Mark could work on a regular basis, the same shape room, the time that he wanted. And so when we did come back to the States, we were determined to find a home, right? We were going to recreate all of the really positive things about our Belgian residency. And that was primary. It took us 10 years to be able to raise the funds, find the right place, and to build a home. And during those 10 years, it was, it's incredibly frustrating to rent space and then have to work within the confines of that, right? If you are not inspired or it's just not coming together, you feel compelled to stay in the room because you're paying for it. Or if the creative juices are flowing and it's going really well, the next company is like knocking on the door because your time is up. And we had one staff person whose full-time job was to find good rehearsal space.
Wow.
So all of that went away when we found our home. Started out really small in that it was a big site. There was supposed to be a partner. And when we actually opened, we only had 3 studios. And the dance center and all of the community programs grew very organically, primarily in response to the expressed needs of the community that we were living in. And when we were still under construction, one of the things we did was call together all of the artists that we could find in Brooklyn, hosted a lunch, and shared the plans. This is what we're building, these 3 studios. And we're on the road 26, 28 weeks of the year. What do you need? What should we do with this space? And from those conversations with those artists in Brooklyn, and then with the dance community, a larger group in Manhattan, it became very clear that people needed rehearsal space and they wanted to pay $8 to $10 an hour. And that's exactly what we did. We built a subsidized studio rental program that to this day is still $10 to $15 an hour.
Wow.
And then the community work came from, again, very organically in a Parkinson's support group reaching out to us when they read that we were moving to Brooklyn, thinking that it would be great if we could send a dancer to them. We said, come to our new studios. And here we are 23 years later with a, you know, international research-backed program that has incredible global reach, 340 communities around the world. Our work with the New York City Housing Authority started because there was a daycare center around the corner, and on a holiday, they were exploring their neighborhood and rang our doorbell, literally, and came in. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. There was no one there except me, and I showed them the studio and said, well, you'll have to come back someday and take class. And we had them come back, and then it started to be a weekly, a monthly, and then we connected to the larger Housing Authority community and now are in numerous centers around Brooklyn. So again, a lot of it really developed very naturally, very organically, and because I think access and community engagement were really important to Mark in the kind of access he had as a kid. So we created some of that and were able to, particularly in the early days, allocate a tremendous amount of human and financial resources in developing that aspect of the organization.
Let's go back to $10 to $15 an hour today in New York City for rehearsal space. That's incredible.
Before we went to Brussels, we were rehearsing in studios that cost an enormous amount of money, probably like $50-$60 at that time was a lot. And that was as long as the elevator didn't shut off or the building, the heat or the air conditioning, you know, it was just like completely plantless. I wanted it to be a place, from our experience living in Belgium, a place where you're comfortable and it's your vocation, it's your job, and you can surprisingly take a shower and have a towel and a private space for you to think that it's an adult job. It's a it's a real vocation, and it's in the arts, which people are skeptical about very often. And dancing isn't the biggest draw in the arts world, but it's, well, to me, obviously, it's really important and interesting. And I'm working from a basis of music. So it's always been, there's always been music involved and a certain idea that you can be at home where you work and it's nothing to apologize for. It's like, you know, you're 35 and you're still dancing. It's like, yeah, thank you. I'm really good. Your name here. So it was like, You know, it wasn't just we need a cheaper space. It was like we need a place that is suited to this kind of work. And very few places are built with dance in mind. You know, there are a lot of details that you have to take care of to make it the best possible, less injurious kind of job that can go on for a long time instead of just, you know, replaceable dancers, which is an awful tradition.
So there are a lot of things about the Mark Morris Dance Center that are outside of just that dance space as well. There is also the Wellness Center there. How intentional was all of that from the beginning, and how did that develop?
So we started out with three studios and a physical therapy room. And it was out of necessity bringing in, not only to bring in physical therapists to work with our dancers, but in order to make that affordable, to be able to provide them with space so they could use the space, see outside clients. And we built a sort of business around that where we could have multiple practitioners working, renting space from us, with us providing the equipment, and then having physical therapists and other types of practitioner on site in an emergency when you needed it. So as we grew, it made sense for the Wellness Center to grow as well. When we expanded to the lower two floors, we built out a much larger space with more individual treatment rooms and full gym equipment so that our dancers could stay in shape and could use that and be a benefit to staff as well. So it was, I don't know that it was intentional to be what it is now. I think it's grown into that. And I think that is pretty much our story, right? The intentionality was a great studio for the company and a backup studio for smaller work. And that's what we were really after initially. And a home for the dancers, a place where they could unpack their dance bag, because traditionally dancers live out of their bag. And so we put a lot of focus on what the dancer dressing room looked like and the kind of spaces that people could be in, so that dancers had a place to go to work, like a lot of other people do.
The dressing rooms were intentionally modeled after a baseball team dressing room. What do you call that? Locker room? Yeah, whatever. You change clothes.
Only much nicer,
right. It was like, so every dancer has his or her own place, their own place. It's like, it's seen as such an incredible luxury, but it's really, it's giving them what's needed. And of course, everybody... We've benefited, back to the Wellness Center idea, we've benefited tremendously. The dance world has benefited from sports medicine, the sort of trickle down of, oh, I'm injured all the time, you know, and we don't make $10 million a season, but you can be injured a lot. It's high stress work. And to become a better artist, there needs to be a certain amount of cross training. So we have a full set of Pilates equipment and free weights and cross training stuff. And people also do yoga or swim or run or bike. A lot of people bike to work, which is the best thing. So that idea of the sort of respect for it and the treatment of people and injury prevention, you know, just doing something a bunch of times is going to pay off in some way. Ouch. So we help with that in a great deal. And that was also part from talking to all the dancers and, you know, people in the business like us who've already been around forever. And then we're trying to make a physical plant that turned out to be great and in Brooklyn and really a dreamy spot. Everybody wants to work there.
I don't blame them. I love that concept of giving it the respect. I think that's really like a great way to explain what you have built there. What I'm curious about is Nancy mentioned sort of the accessibility factor and focusing on like that being a priority, and sort of it seems that it's what's led you to sort of consistently say yes. I mean, to sort of, you know, you have somebody come knock on your door and all of a sudden you're doing dance programs for this and you're doing dance programs for this because of that. So I'm curious, where does that desire come from to focus on that accessibility? Why do you see that as important as you do?
To make this not a conservatoire and not a university. As I say, I don't have much book learning, and, you know, everyone loves to say, you know, if you're an autodidact, how do you know the word autodidact? It's kind of like that. It's like, well, excuse me, you know, I wasn't born yesterday, and I know some stuff because I've traveled so much and I'm really interested in music and dancing and show business and opera and people and travel. That all added up to, what do you want to learn how to do? And it was really like, can we get not just the Parkinson's dance for PD, but also what do kids want? And, you know, what would be mommy and baby classes are family classes, like with little kids, and there's dancing for older people and if you're lucky, everybody's an older person. Well, you are from the beginning. It's a different kind of, it's not the kind of high pressure of getting a BFA in dance or something. I want people to dance so you can decide if you want to or not. If you've never done it, how do you know you hate it or that you want to do it? And it makes you, it does different things to you sort of neurologically. It's like, oh, I took dance lessons. You know, everybody had a girlfriend who was a dancer at some point. It's like, well, small world, but also it can be a career and it can be something that belongs in the world and in the culture because it already is every place. So, you know, we have a West African dance class. It's been a huge hit for many years. Like a lot of people who come very regularly and a team of drummers who are fabulous. And then there's, you know, there's salsa and there's capoeira, you know, like some martial arts stuff. And there's some yoga classes. Like there's a whole big variety and we rotate it. The stuff that succeeds, we keep it going and we add and subtract stuff. There's so many kids around. And then the more, sometimes the more fragile and older people who are in the Parkinson's program and everybody runs into each other and gets along and, you know, pushes your way out the door. It's a very, very active place. And that's what we want. Like here, dance, and here's some music. Just about every single class that we teach has live music because that's a real, real.
That was going to be my next question.
Well, let's skip it because I just answered. Yeah.
No, I mean,
no, go ahead.
Live music is very important to you, and so that was as you were talking about all these classes that are in the building.
Yeah,
I'm thinking how many musicians would you have to actually facilitate all of these classes, but you do.
I thought you were going to say to change a light bulb. Because I have an answer for that one. No. Boy, I don't know, Nancy.
I don't know the exact number, but we have about 140 teaching artists and musicians. Oh. So, and we have, I think, roughly about 180 classes a week at the moment, not counting Dance for Parkinson's. So it's a lot, right? I mean, there are classes that don't have live music, right? Our tap classes, our hip-hop classes, although occasionally we bring in DJs for those. You know, it's what we do. You know, we used to say sort of dance music community. That's what makes this company different than other modern dance companies.
So as the company's developed, Mark Morris Music Group has also come out of this, right? I'm probably butchering that name.
In 1996, we established the MMDG Music Ensemble.
And okay.
It operated under that name for quite a number of years. And now we have shifted the overall company name from going Mark Morris Dance Group and MMDG Music Ensemble to the Mark Morris Dance Group and Music Ensemble.
Okay.
And the only time we don't use that full name is when we are working, let's say, with a local orchestra and not traveling with our own musicians. But it is an integral part of what we do. And unless there is a piece of music that can't be played live or wasn't intended to be played live, or there's a very specific recording that defines the piece, then we would do it live or we wouldn't do it.
Talking about live music and how important live music is, it's something that you're dearly passionate about. With having things that are an absolute must like that, you have referred to yourself in a number of interviews as a difficult artist. And I just kind of want to know, one, where that self-prescribed difficult artist, where that comes from, and has that ever been an issue for you with any collaboration or partnership creating the art in that way?
Difficult artist. I would say I'm a difficult person. I don't think I'm a difficult artist.
A demanding artist.
Demanding artist, yeah. I mean, I'm an asshole, but I'm also a man. So that's kind of done right there. It's like, oh, you know, fine. It's partly because I work very rapidly in my mind, which is different from getting it across to other people. So I'm strict, I'm demanding, I'm impatient, I'm lots of fun, I'm volatile, I'm reliable. You know, that's one reason we have worked together for so long is that we're finished. When we show up and promise the premiere, it's done and we just do it. You know, we're very, very reliable. Difficult meaning, I also am sort of frank. Like, how did you like that show of somebody else's? Of course, no, not only, but how did you like the show? I said, that was terrible. Or, you know, I love when my opinion comes up about something. The idea of, you know, I say, well, that, you know, I went to that opera and act three was fine, but the rest was terrible. And it's like, oh, you know, and people say like, you know, oh, we were at a different show, which just means you liked it and I didn't. Good. That's what I want. I don't want everybody to do the, you know, anesthetized Disney industry response of, you know, that's good for everybody. And, you know, there's no friction in that. Not just that I'm looking for fights, but if you say like, that sucked, that was the worst piece of shit I've ever seen, then people often say to someone like me or me, why don't you tell us how you really feel? And it's like, I already cleaned it up. My mind runs a little more blue than a lot of people's do. And I'm frank, I'm confusing. You know, I'm not just a choreographer, director, whatever, artistic. I'm also like a thinking, kooky person. And my interests change a lot. And I stay interested because of the people I work with, dancers in particular, and certainly musicians, and then designers. And, you know, the responsibility of the work, because I don't use a lot of sets or video or anything like that. I do pretty pared down stuff a lot, lighting and sets and costume and music, and that's kind of it. I'm old fashioned in that I want live music, which I like to just call music, but you know, I mean, music is a big topic. Mm-hmm. Music, dance, people, text, in the theater, alive, and then it's over when it's over, and that show never happens again. Even if you're doing a month long run of the show, they're never the same because it's all living elements, and that's my biggest thing. So I'm difficult. That's the answer.
In many things that you've expressed just today in this discussion, you're incredibly well-traveled. You have absorbed the cultures that you have been in and been around. But at the same time, you say, I don't have a lot of book learning. Mm-hmm. And at any point in your career, has there been any imposter syndrome or anything that you felt from a confidence standpoint that you've had to overcome even early in your career due to being around people that were potentially all had college training and you didn't, or anything like that? I say this myself because I'm a high school graduate and that's where it ended. Mm-hmm. And in the arts administration world, there's not a lot of people like me in that facet. And I've faced a lot of that myself. And so I pose that question to you.
Well, I have 11 honorary doctorates. I'm a doctor times a bunch. I'm sorry, I can't write a prescription, but it was a fabulous honor. And whenever that's happened, I just sob. I sit on stage in my outfit and just sob through the whole thing. It's like, I'm so proud of everybody, the children I never had and won't. Let's see. I think imposter syndrome, I love that term because I think that's just about everybody. I don't know anybody who does not have some kind of imposter, even if they don't think they're a very good imposter. That's a kind of imposter syndrome. I'm certainly defensive about being uneducated, but I'm smart. I'm not that scared. I mean, I'm chicken. That's one reason I come on strong is because I'm scared shitless all the time. Like most people in show business don't really want anybody to look at them. That's why you dance. The audience is in the dark and you're not, because you're dancing generally. And if you're dancing specifically, which you feel like you are, you actually are. But you don't want the crowd to see. It's a weird thing. You know, it's like that's why you do it. You know,
there's a quote that I want to bring up about you as a dancer. It's on the Wikipedia page about Mark Morris, the choreographer.
Oh, Wikipedia. That's extremely, extremely valuable.
It is.
Yeah. And impossible that anything could be wrong.
So
Josh wrote it earlier.
I did. I was the contributor.
Okay.
It says Mark was long noted for the musicality and power of his dancing, as well as his amazing delicacy of movement. His body was heavier than the typical dancers, more like that of an average person, yet his technical and expressive abilities outstripped those of most of his contemporaries. Reading that and having watched your company and knowing that a lot of your dancers are not necessarily the standard stereotypical dancer build.
Which is what and why?
I'm going off of a quote from you saying, I have larger women and smaller men because the balance between them on stage is better in that way. With that, I just wonder how much your representation as a dancer led to the way that you fill out your company with dancers in a casting situation.
Okay. What is it, Nancy?
I'm looking for that quote that I shared with you about body types.
Remember, oh, good. Yeah, look that up.
I'm looking
for
that.
No, you were shaking your head, so I thought, uh-oh, the show's off. It's okay. Why I said that about who what's a stereotypical dancer. That's entirely based on the ballet industry and no other kind of dancing. It doesn't exist elsewhere. I love ballet. I have no problem. I worship ballet. I love pointe shoes. I love the music. I love the technique. I teach that technique because I think it's very valuable as a, you know, lingua franca. But it's not, you know, it used to be years ago and still is a little bit like you become a modern dancer, as it's called, which is fine with me, because you failed as a ballet dancer. Like your feet are too big or your ass is too big or you're too short or tall or you got breasts when you hit that age. It's like, and I'm a dancer. Here I am dancing, but there's no room for me now because things have changed. I don't fit into that, into the scene or the costume or whatever. There's also, I was never felt welcome there, your name here. I never felt welcome there, so I don't feel like I can approach that. It's a prejudice from experience. You know, it's not, it's like, well, you don't look like a dancer. It's like, well, I'm dancing. Done. The verb.
No, I'm just going to read this quote about, you know, oh, yeah, you talked about of the body. And this is attributed to Jenny Gilbert from The Independent.
Oh, great.
Some time ago, right? Tell Mark Morris he's fat and he'll readily admit it. Remark that he's unfit for a man pushing 50 and he has no quarrel with that. But suggest that he's become the choreographer he is because he lacks the ideal dancer's body and he goes dangerously quiet and pale eyes start to blaze. So just what is the ideal dancer's body? If you're talking about a white girl who weighs 110 pounds and has been wearing pink since birth, you're right. And if you're talking about some Russian 9-year-old kid whose x-rays have made it past the Bolshoi Selection Committee, then you're right again. But if you're talking about people who dance and are great artists like myself, then you're talking about the whole rest of the world whose culture isn't Eurocentric. I'm particularly offended by that question. You can criticize someone for not being able to dance, but you can't say they can't dance just because they're ugly or have big tits. For me, the ideal dancer's body is a racist, sexist, and ageist notion that I reject.
There. That could have been the whole thing. That's the whole podcast right there. I forgot the intro to that. That is fabulous.
I don't think that could have been summed up any more perfectly.
Wild?
That's beautiful.
That's good writing.
I want to shift gears just a little bit to sort of the business side of things. Obviously, there has been a lot that you've accomplished, and this is something I think I could dig into for an hour alone because this is the side that fascinates me. But one of the things that I'm really curious about is Mark has already said that his mind moves from thing to thing very quickly and, you know, wants to do sort of a little bit of everything, it sounds like. I'm curious to sort of the challenges that it takes to focus the business, but also balance that artistic side with the commercial side, the need for finance is like, how do you go about striking that balance?
You mean when I say to him, you've got to give me a new closer?
Yeah.
Like that? like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there is the reality of what works in certain markets. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the trust where I can say, we can't do that piece. It's fabulous. It's but we've never been to that market. They won't know how to look at it. Mm-hmm. Or the program order. You know, there's a piece that we've been doing, A Wooden Tree, which is to an Ivor Cutler recording. And if we go to a market and we've never performed there, I say we can't open with that piece because it's like, what's going on? But if it's the second piece on the program and you've already watched something and you get a sense of the movement with music that's a little bit more familiar or less challenging, then you know how to be surprised by the next piece. So I can make those kinds of very specific requests, like that's the wrong program order for here. Mm-hmm. And I do pride myself in being the number one expert audience member for Mark Morris Dance Crew performances I've seen more than any other human on the planet.
Including me.
Yeah, because for the first 15 years, he was on stage for those shows. So I think part of it is just being really frank about what works and what doesn't work. You know, the work is good. I mean, it's kind of that simple.
You know, Nancy, what honestly fascinates me about that answer, and I love the way that your mind works, is that in my thought process of like thinking through that was going, okay, well, you know, we've got to, you know, sort of increase our rentals or increase our donations to make this happen. But your mind instantly went to the art, went, oh, you know, the only thing we need to do is we need to shift the pieces order, or we need to, you know, change these things around to make us more viable in that market versus, you know, focusing on the, like, strictly the dollars aspect. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that. Like, because I think most people have a tendency to focus basically just on the bottom line and focus on, I mean, which obviously, I mean, you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's an oversimplification and one that worked really well pre-pandemic, right? Mm. The structural shift in the industry is such that it doesn't, at this point, it doesn't matter how good the work is because audiences aren't back, particularly in certain markets, because the funding has become completely destabilized. The whole funding support foundation has been destabilized. Revenue is not what it was. And I think coming back from the pandemic, which masked so many problems within the field, you know, we all made significant investments in infrastructure, in personnel, the assumption that there would be a 2-year, 3-year runway to get back to something that we knew, and that's never going to happen. I think my answer was incredibly naive in that is what I do believe. But the truth is that it's not sustainable. Good art is not sustainable. Shit art is not sustainable. I mean, art is not sustainable in our world right now. We've always lived in a culture that doesn't value it. Mm-hmm. And now we have the 501c3 experiment collapsing, right? Because it's at the whim of a few and the wealthy, and doesn't work. I also think one of the things that's happening right now is the shift in, and there needs to be a recalibration in the field, absolutely, mm-hmm. right? But we've got the pandemic, we've got Black Lives Matter, we've got George Floyd, we've got Me Too, we've got a lot that arts and culture is trying to contend with in terms mm-hmm. of what it means to be, a good human being, right? And how do we undo some of the grave injustices of the past? All of that is true, but I think there has been such a shift, such a swing of the pendulum with no runway, with no preparation. In some ways, I feel like the shift of some of the major foundations and major institutional support moving away from institutions and towards individual artists, moving away from arts and culture into everything that needs to be funded because of the last administration, right? Yeah. We need to fund reproductive rights. We need to mm-hmm. fund climate change. We need to fund social justice. But this or instead of and mm-hmm. has been a real problem. And I fear that what it's going to do is not what its intention is or was, because by taking money away from the institutions that support artists, you're making them more reliant on rich white people, which I don't think is the intention. And by putting the money into the hands of the artists and not the institutions that have supported them, you're forcing them to become artist administrators mm-hmm. and take time away from their own artistic practice. So I'm not sure what the plan is. I mean, mm-hmm. I get what the, what the intention is, but I just don't think this plan is going to work. I certainly don't know where it's taking us.
That's, I mean, honestly, we are on the exact same page. Yeah. We saw massive funders that we were getting five figures from, and all of a sudden we went zero.
Yeah.
Like within one phase. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it's like, what happened here? Yeah. And it causes a lot of, problems down the road, but also like everything that you mentioned, we're also dealing with, like you mentioned, like climate change. I'm like mm-hmm. working, working towards like livable wages, affordable housing,
wars,
all of, yes, yeah. everything right convening now. At once. And there's this notion of this idea that like people like to talk about, that the arts can fix a lot of these things or do like make progress in a lot of these things, which I 100% agree with, but we're not going to fund it.
Right.
Like you got to go out and do that, which then, has that mission creep aspect of like, you're now beholden to certain large donors or certain, other institutions.
Well, chasing the money.
And, exactly.
There's a lot of chasing the money. I think one of the things is, I don't want to put all the blame on the funding community because it's also on the presenting community and driven by the funding community. Yeah. Right. I mean, one of our biggest challenges is that our source, the Mark Morris Dance Group's primary source of earned revenue comes from institutions, organizations, presenters, individuals who mm-hmm. rely on contributed income. If we're being hurt on the contributed income side, we're being hurt on the earned revenue side as well because those sources depend on contributed, right? Most of those presenters need their funding in order to be able to pay us our earned revenue. Mm-hmm. In some ways it's a really vicious cycle. But I want to say it's not just on the contributed revenue side and the foundations, but also on the presenter side that have many that have shifted in big ways. So yes, we have had funders who have given us six figures for consistently for 20 years that suddenly have gone to zero. But we've also had presenters where we have performed for 20 years in a row that have suddenly said, oh, we're no longer presenting artists like you. Mm-hmm. We're no longer presenting Western classical music or work that's based on Western European culture. So you no longer have a home here after 23 consistent mm-hmm. years, and find a new place to perform next year because we're done. Right. So those kinds of really quick changes are really destabilizing, regardless of how good the work yeah. is.
There's also developed a bizarre expectation that the arts are somehow supposed to unite and heal and spread love all over. And that's a possibility. You know, it's another story with visual arts and literature and stuff like that, but they're related. But the stuff that happens at that time in that place where nothing is supposed to be disturbing, there's mm-hmm. supposed to be a trigger warning on something, you know, which I understand it, but it's also like, it's show business is also a certain aspect of fiction. So to see someone who's like you, that's important, but also to be able to recognize how a piece is constructed. And, you know, and famously opera has been the milieu of gay men, specifically opera queens. That's what we're called. And I'm one, I'm proud to be one. But the thing is, it's not like because I see gay or queer people being portrayed in the opera, it's that I see the situation between the soprano and the tenor leads. I see their relationship. Mm-hmm. And as we know, a lot of 19th century opera ends with some horrible female tragedy like classical ballet. I can read that as that could have been me instead of Violetta. And that's the identification that should be recognized in art that isn't turning King Lear into the former evil president. You know, it's like that doesn't make it relevant. It just makes it confusing and dated. And so the idea that you know, it's a balm for the soul. Absolutely. I love that. But I don't use music to go to sleep to, you know, and I listen to many different kinds for various reasons. And that's my appetite, is to have a bunch of different feelings of unease and fear. And, you know, everybody loves horror movies, and that's every opera.
I mean, I could stay here with the two of you for hours.
You have.
I've got one question for each of you just before we go. Mm-hmm. If you could go back and just as you were leaving to travel and absorb the world as a dancer and choreographer, what advice would you have for yourself?
For myself?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't have any for my young self.
Uh-huh.
It's like right on, Mary. Yeah, go for it. Good for you. I don't know. I don't look at it as a do-over. You know, I did some stupid shit, but which would be nice if I didn't, but that's also part of you, you know. You have a scar. That's what you look like now. I don't really have regrets or anything. My advice for choreographers is make up a dance. My advice for everybody is listen to more music and read and look around and try foods you don't like and go someplace you're scared of and, you know, have some, I don't know, chutzpah.
That's probably my favorite answer that we've ever had on the podcast.
That's good.
Run for your lives. That's the other possible answer. Yeah.
Nancy, as you were turning down Garth Fagan Dance as a dancer coming out of college and focusing your vision into arts administration, despite an obvious prowess for dance, what advice would you have for yourself?
Dental school.
You've invested a lot in other people's dental school over the years. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I have no regrets about the career path that I've taken. But, you know, let's face it. Right now, this business sucks. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. Mm-hmm. It's really, really hard. If I had gone to dental school, you know, I would be on the board of a dance company. And then maybe I could be, I don't know, a little less stressed these days.
Right on.
Two great answers.
I love it. Cheaper dental rates because I don't have good teeth. So that would have helped too.
I always said that I've told my mother that it was a lie, but I always said about it, I had to choose between orthodontia and dancing lessons, and dancing lessons were cheaper. And she was so outraged. I said it a lot. She was like, Mark, how dare you? It's like, I was just lying, but I thought it was funny. And it isn't, but that's why I'm this and not that.
Well, my father actually, when I said that I wanted to study dance, my father actually said to me, you should become a dentist. You can be on the board of a dance company. And I said, that's a terrible idea.
I didn't know that was his idea.
Oh, wow. It was his idea, you know, 40-some-odd years ago. Yeah. And, you know, if he's, you know, looking down, not that I believe that necessarily, but he, you know, I think he would be glad that I just said that. I don't think he thought it would turn out this way, but.
Right. Yeah. I told you so.
Yeah.
I've got one final question for you.
Okay.
Whenever the New York Times said that you are the most successful, influential choreographer alive and indisputably the most musical, what feeling did that give you as far as what you've accomplished?
It's a relief. You know, well, that's the thing. Like Nancy said, we do good work. And so if people say, that's another reason that I'm so difficult, is somebody says like, that show was so great. It's like, well, of course, that's the point. And it's like, here, let me make up the third best dance ever. Like, I don't think that. I'm talking about myself. It's not a competition because I like other people's work and I love watching dancers and music and if it's good. So it's like, it's good. Oh, thank you. I agree. You know, that show was great. Yeah, I think so, too. That's not even blowing my own horn. It's like, well, sure, I choreograph. So I have dances to watch that I like. You know, if I was satisfied with all of Balanchine and Merce Cunningham, I love that stuff. They were really good choreographers. I didn't like all of it. So I'm working in that model, not just the famous ones, but all the other ones, living and dead. I fit into that in like, here's a dance. Good luck, you know, but I think it's good. So I was happy with that.
Well, thank you both for being here today.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you for giving us your time. And being so open and transparent with us, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you.
Thanks.
I didn't want to talk over you. Yeah, thanks, guys. Yeah.
Josh and Kevin, thanks for bringing us this interview with Nancy and Mark. We all got to meet them in New York this past APAP, and I had the pleasure of working with them this past fall. As much as I would love to talk about his work and his dances and how incredible it is, because it's amazing, and everyone should go find the opportunity to see Mark Morris Dance Group when it comes to a town near them. But what I wanted to focus on was something we talked about at the end of the beginning of this conversation with us, when Katie was talking about body type, and then Mark talks about that at some point. And as you all know, my wife was a professional ballerina, and it's a real thing, that body image. He asked you and you didn't answer what the typical dancer body type is, but for the ballerina world at the time that my wife was in it, it was a certain height. You couldn't be over a certain height. You had to be really thin. You had to be, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And she had an eating disorder so she could stay, you know, in the dance world and make a professional career. And it affected her physically. It affected her when we came to try to have children. I mean, there were so many awful things that came way after those periods of her dancing because of her eating disorder and other issues, dancing through the pain. I mean, I can go on and on about all of the things, the harmful things and toxic things that she had to endure to keep that career. You know, I'm so grateful to hear the way Mark approaches with his dancers and the care he has for preventative and also to help them, you know, with injuries and things that are going to happen. It's just, you know, night and day from the experience that my wife had. And hopefully that's a growing movement that is happening within the dance world.
I do think you have seen a huge shift in transition in this idea around body type. I mean, just a company we've talked about before on the show, Hiplay, ballerinas out of Chicago, Ladies of Hip Hop out of New York. And there's numerous companies now that are really tossing aside this prescribed notion of what a dancer should look like and are working with dancers of all shapes, sizes, ages, races. It's a beautiful thing to see. Dancers like Misty Copeland that have really made it their mission to help break down some of those unconscious biases that we have and make that something that people are held accountable for, that company leaders are held accountable for, is thinking about that as not only the physical representation, but also the health implications like you're talking about, Brian. So I'm very glad to hear Mark talk about this in this way. And also actually have witnessed the shift in the industry personally myself in working with artists and seeing dance companies come through and when we're at conferences and things like that. It's definitely noticeable.
Well, but that's also a place too where as an individual and as, you know, somebody who works for an organization is to always remember that like you vote every day with your money and with your attention. I mean, I've learned a lot more about myself and what I like in dance because it wasn't something that I grew up seeing a lot of. I've really kind of learned to figure out what kind of dance I like kind of as an adult. And what's most interesting is the movement of bodies. I don't care what the body types are, but it's about the storytelling and it's about that motion in and around each other, the relationships, like what the dancers' individual bodies look like isn't anything that I've ever cared to care about in selecting kind of like a performance that I want to see. And so if that's something that you don't feel like you want to support, then, you know, think about other ways that you do or don't support something.
When Nancy was talking about Mark's background and growing up in the Seattle area and how he became a dancer was through the opportunities and access that he had and how he'd taken that to when they created the Mark Morris Dance Center to keep it affordable for the community. I mean, I just thought that whole story was incredible. I love that you guys highlighted even the real dollars that they're talking about, $10 to $15 an hour. That is amazing. You can't find that in rural areas, let alone New York City. It's just so community minded. And I loved, you know, I love that. And I think it probably already has paid in dividends in helping foster people that never would have had an opportunity to be exposed to dance, let alone maybe even find that they have a spark for it to grow and choose that as their career because of the Mark Morris Dance Group.
And that's just such a service to the dance community and to that industry.
Yeah, that dance center is really ingrained in that community as well. And the things that we really didn't dive into in this conversation is just how involved in the community outside of that. Obviously, the building has a very prominent location, but they're doing things inside that community as well. I mean, Nancy is also sitting on, you know, some tourism chamber of commerce type groups there to be able to help drive that and drive that home because they want to be part of that community, want to see their community grow. And it just goes to show that, I mean, we talk about it all the time, like the arts creates a community and it also helps to drive that community. And so they're putting their money where their mouth is and their time as well.
And to follow that, Kevin, like when they were creating that space and envisioning that space, they pulled together the dance community and asked for their input and what was needed and what was necessary, which I really loved. And I don't, when they were doing that process, like that is not something that I think that was very forward looking and not something that a lot of people would have done at that time. And I don't think a lot of people still do now, even though it is a best practice is to involve your community in those sorts of conversations. And also, I think thinking about dance is a vocation and the respect that Mark and Nancy both have for the dance community and dance as a profession and the care that they took in creating these spaces, particularly the dressing rooms, right? And I love that actually that analogy that Mark used to baseball, like hashtag sports ball, but they're even better because they have so much respect for dancers as professionals and our wider community. Nancy makes this point later on in the conversation that like our culture just doesn't really respect the arts as a profession, right? In whatever avenue you're in. And I loved how much time and care and respect they put into that process of creating these spaces for artists to use, you know, and that's going to stand the test of time.
Well, I think too, that ties into envisioning that wellness center also, you know, having a gym for the dancers to have access to, because that's also a huge personal expense if you don't have that access at your work, and having the physical therapist on site, like for their benefit of if somebody gets really injured and they need somebody fast, but also to help their employees preserve, you know, their bodies, which is their ability to keep working, and then to provide those services in some way to the community. I mean, that's just a really holistic way to think about all of the needs that you have as a dance company.
And that's one thing about Mark's company is that a lot of his dancers have more longevity than typical dancers within the industry. He currently has people in his company that are over the age of 40 that are still actively dancing with the company and touring.
So switching gears, I want to think about this kind of the second half of your conversation with Nancy in particular, when she was talking about funding structures and the recalibration of the industry in really the last 5 years or so. And I think this is a really nuanced conversation and a very complex conversation, and one that we are nibbling around the edges at as an industry, like presenters, agents, artists. We kind of have these conversations about how funding structures are changing very suddenly. but I'm sort of waiting for this to break wide open for us to have a real conversation with the philanthropy sector about it and really get into it with them. Because I think what Nancy said is right on. We are getting a little bit of whiplash and funding structures are changing. And not that any of these other social issues and things happening in the world don't deserve time and energy and attention and money, because they absolutely do. But there are real world implications and consequences to that funding being withdrawn so quickly. And you guys talked about that a little bit. So it really struck me, and I'm waiting for the ball to drop at more institutions across the country as this continues to shift and change. And if we don't have truthful, real conversations with funders now, I think those long-term consequences that Nancy was speaking about are only going to continue to snowball.
I also appreciated how Nancy phrased that it's not an funding or situation, but it's an and situation. There should be a solution that we can all work together in lifting everyone up.
I do also too think that the larger picture view of this is that this system of nonprofits, 501c3s, is only 50, 60 years old. And, you know, Nancy refers to it as an experiment. And it has created an arts economy ecosystem that has lasted. But the implication of relying in a lot of ways on tax incentives for corporations and for individuals has just created instability in organizations year to year budgeting, because you never know what your state and local contributions are going to be, what access to grants from those entities you're going to be eligible for. The requirements change on a yearly basis, you know, depending on how many taxes that the state brings in is how much they have to disperse throughout any given state. And then the same with your contributed income from your local foundations and your local donors. All of that can change overnight. You can be promised something at the beginning of a fiscal year, and you know, an individual can not give it at the end. And so organizations are in this constant loop of projecting where they think the money is going to come from, and then trying to get it and trying to find new sources of income. And it takes a ton of effort. You know, there's a lot of organizations where their development team is half of their staff, if not more. And that's not a great way to make art.
I think one false sense of security that was created was through the COVID relief funding, because donors and funders were dropping out during that time, but the COVID relief funding was there, creating a false sense of security for a lot of organizations. And then coming off of the COVID funding, the funders weren't there, and it created that whiplash feeling that would have been created by COVID 2 years prior. But that created a false sense of security for so many organizations. And there are so many organizations that now, during this time, are closing their doors because of that false sense of security that happened. And there wasn't a drive to replicate or replace that funding because they had the COVID funding.
Yeah, and that COVID funding, you know, also being simultaneously with the increased cost of staffing and the increased cost of just, you know, food or literally everything at that same time. And then, you know, we ramped up our expenses and then had to drop down on that funding. And I think what's really challenging is I think some people will listen to what Danielle said and talk about, you know, the granting side of things and go, oh, well, you shouldn't be budgeting for your grants. Like, you shouldn't expect to have this year over year, because that's a general thing that people like to tell you. But the reality is that you also have to look at, you know, you have to make some assumptions. You have to make some, you know, hypotheses as far as like what is going to come in a traditional year. And if historically you have gotten a consistent amount from an organization, it would dictate that odds are you are going to get it that year. And when many of those don't come through in a certain year, it can be detrimental. And it can be hard or impossible to recover from, but it definitely creates some hurdles.
So like I said, I think this is a complicated and nuanced conversation, but it is something that desperately needs to happen. And I thank Nancy for bringing it up as a part of this conversation. I'm sitting here going like, what's next? Do we have these conversations with funders at an individual organizational level, or is there a wider industry conversation, like real truthful, hard conversation that needs to happen with funders and the philanthropy sector and the art sector. And who facilitates that? And who is in charge of that? Like, how do we make
all
that
great happen? Questions, Katie. So let's all go to Wikipedia right now and see if we can find the answers.
So to quote Wikipedia, thank you for joining us here on There's No Business Like. Thank you, Mark and Nancy, for sitting down with us. Thanks to the rest of the Quad producers for being here with me, and Kevin for sitting down with me with Mark and Nancy. We'll see y'all next time.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening to There's No Business Like. Our producers and hosts are Brian Zellmer, Josh Benson, Kevin Maynard, Katie Miller, and me, Danielle Van Hoek. Views expressed in this podcast are ours alone and are not reflective of the organizations we are a part of. Keep up with us at nobusinesslike.com. There you'll find links to all of our episodes and socials. If you like this podcast, give us a like, a follow, a review, or our favorite, a 5-star rating. Oh, wait, what was that site? I got it. Don't worry. It is nobusinesslike.com. Do I sound out bus I-ness every time I type it? Yep, sure do. Stay in touch, my friends.
Does anyone see that? It's blue?
Blue.
That's her chair.
Oh, it's her chair. It's your chair.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, there's nothing there. What are you seeing behind me?
I was like, I see it too, but...